We have two petitioners in an awkward situation for aligning argument time. The two petitioners, David Rourke and Dr. Allen, will each be given 20 minutes to open. Counsel for the other doctor, Matthews, will be given 20 minutes to respond. Then the petitioners, Rourke and Allen, will be given 10 minutes to close. That's more time than is usually given for an argument, but that's the way we think it might be. If it becomes obvious that you need more time, maybe we'll give you more time. Call now Rourke against Allen. Counsel, please come to the counsel table. Your argument from petition.
May it please the court, Mr. John H. Holloway will be representing Mr. David Rourke.
Court, please. Your Honor, simple matters sometimes become complicated by the approach that's taken to it. One of the problems that is faced in this particular petition is a question of the pleadings. Although the court has granted the writ on behalf of Mr. Rourke, directed primarily to the question of an abuse of discretion in the trial court's failure to permit the plaintiff to file an amended or a trial amendment of the pleadings at the close of the case. I would direct the court's attention again to the pleadings themselves as filed in the original petition, to which no exception was ever leveled by anyone up through about page 188 of the statement of facts. The pleadings again state that following the attempt to deliver, Dr. Allen obtained a consultation of Dr. Matthews. The pleadings go on to say, and according to the information furnished the plaintiff, Dr. Matthews effected the allowed injury. Now, this is not, as the defendant claims, an admission against interest. It's a statement merely in the pleadings. Then it next picks up the paragraph.
Which pleadings are you reading?
From the plaintiff, original petition. It says, as a result of the delivery or attempt to delivery by the defendant jointly and severally, the infant sustained bilateral depressed skull fractures. The petition goes on to say that the defendants were negligent jointly and severally, and because of this approximate cause of negligence, this child suffered an injury. The unusual aspect of this case is that during the trial it became apparently evident to the defendants that a shift over to who was the alleged expert or the OB specialist might be advantageous, and that's what they did. They shifted the initial injury aspect from the doctor who was improperly, according to the plaintiff's testimony, utilizing the forceps. The young man, either they forgot about him being present or whatever the reason was. The young father was there present during the delivery. He described a technique by the attending doctor of improper application by using one of the forceps in an attempt to turn the child. It was conceded that this was improper and could probably injure the child's head by the use of the forceps. But be that as it may, the record is totally devoid of a motion for a continuance, a motion to withdraw announcement for ready.
Counsel, I fail to see what your point is. Where are you going?
Your Honor, I'm initially covering my petition, which says, basically on the ground of the writ, that it was error for the trial court not to grant a trial amendment.
You haven't told us what the trial amendment was yet.
The trial amendment was nothing more than to allege that the defendant Matthews was negligent in the use of the forceps. They claimed that the question of forceps was not raised by the pleadings. My suggestion to the court is that the pleadings do raise the issue, and the appellate court should have so held in the first place. Now, I don't think it requires a great deal of imagination to approach a plaintiff's pleading that says that the fractures occurred from the delivery process. Now, it says, at one point we're talking about a frank breech birth, we're talking about the use of forceps. And that's all. I say it's a simple lawsuit going in. There is no other place in the record that you can find any testimony that suggests that the bilateral fractures of this child's skull could occur from any source other than the forceps themselves. It's conceded. In fact, the dentist's judicial admission by Dr. Matthews in the final analysis was that the sole cause of the two fractures of this child's skull was from his use of the forceps when he says that they slipped. And there's two persons, actually three indirectly, who testified that in the process of applying the forceps to try to reach and extract this child, that the forceps came loose, and he explains that as being on the basis of a defective forceps. He said that some 2 or 3 years later, while he was delivering another child, that the forceps used by him did the same thing, and that is, he had them. There are two interlocking devices that comprises one handle once they're applied over the head. Now, if he loses the grip of that in the application, he will lose the forceps so that they come loose and can fracture the child's skull if pressure is applied. Now, Your Honor, and if this court please, there is ample evidence. There are no exceptions to the pleadings. The case was tried without any indication from the defendants that they were surprised by any of the testimony. They merely decided to change horses in the middle of the stream and grasp upon the fact that it does not say with particularity that the skull was fractured by the forceps. That's the whole case that this court has before it.
And you asked for a trial amendment. The trial court denied it, but he submitted issues on it. Isn't that right?
Yes, sir. And that's one of the points that I tried to make in the application itself. On each occasion that the objections were made, the court overruled the objection. The trial court apparently felt, as I argued to him, that the pleadings were sufficient to raise the issue. Now, not only that, but when they objected to no pleadings, the court submitted the issues. They moved on a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and again, on the basis of no pleading, the trial court denied their motion. Frankly, I do not understand the reversal and rendition upon the facts. There is a jury finding of negligence. It's a judicial admission of the doctor that he caused the fractures. I do not see that the pleadings are really material to any part of the appeal, except for the fact that the appellate court ruled that there were no pleadings to raise the issue.
Would you read to me exactly what you did plead that you say all this caused for them?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, I can. It states that following the attempted delivery, that is by Dr. Allen, that he obtained Dr. Matthews in consultation. And this statement is, according to the information furnished plaintiff, Dr. Matthews effected the delivery of the child without difficulty to the child's head by the use of forceps. That's what the suggestion is. It says, as a result of the delivery or attempts at delivery by the defendant jointly and severally, the infant sustained bilateral depressed skull fractures, requiring his admission to the hospital. It says, as a result of the injuries suffered, that he required hospitalization. Paragraph 3 then says, as a direct and proximate cause of the negligence of the defendants, jointly and severally, that an injury occurred and that damages should be awarded. Now, there, you're talking about a deliberate process. You're talking about the use of a single instrument, a forceps. That's the entire lawsuit. That, there wasn't anything else insofar as the child's injury was concerned.
You mentioned forceps in the petition?
Yes, sir. I said, well, I said that according to the information furnished the plaintiff, that Dr. Matthews didn't injure it with the forceps. But there was no question from the entire evidence in the case that there was an attempt initially to use the forceps by Dr. Allen, when it was plaintiff's position that the injury probably occurred. The difficulty is when the defendant switched horses, and then rather than Dr. Matthews claim that he did not injure it, suddenly he said he was the one who injured the child's head and not the other doctor. The jury bought that story and did properly hold Dr. Matthews liable. But the point is that if you approach the statement of facts in this case, you're almost to page 188 talking about the use of forceps, both proper and improper. My young man, as plaintiff, described the use of the forceps by both doctors. He said they used them like a pair of crowbar, or like a crowbar to try to pry this child out of the vaginal tract. In the...
Now, there was no objection to that testimony.
No objection ever made to it until much later. The testimony, even at one point of time, was from Dr. Allen himself. And it's only through the attempts to develop the standard of care that the objection came about. And what happened is Dr. Allen's counsel objected to the question about the use of the forceps simply on the basis that it failed to state that the standard of care in Fort Worth must be applied. And my contention was it doesn't matter, that under the evidence, the delivery of a child in Fort Worth is no different than Harris County or someplace else. And that basically it was there. But the point is, if you look at the record and you apply the law to it, there was a trial by consent. Secondly, if not, then there, the rules provide liberal amendment of pleadings. We did offer that amendment. That's the second thing. But more importantly than that, Your Honor, I think you've got to look to the trial judge himself. And in this particular instance, each and every time they raised the objection, he concluded it was raised by the pleading. Each and every time they moved for any affirmative relief from it, the trial judge, looking to the pleadings, looking to the parties, held that it was raised by the pleadings. Or otherwise, he would have had to sustain their objection initially. And I think it evident. One of the other things that's unique is that this young man was out of the state of Washington, was trying a lawsuit out of his own pocket there in Fort Worth. I think the judge kind of felt at that point of time that they had switched horses to try to dislodge the obvious negligence of Dr. Allen's use of the forceps. And that in view of that fact, that possibly he was trying to attempt to force the plaintiff to withdraw plaintiff's announcement of ready. But I've cited some authorities to the court, and I respectfully suggest, Your Honor, it's a game, and that's all it is. And the worst game in town is medical malpractice litigation. In this particular case, this child suffered a serious injury. You're talking about a $12,000 judgment between two defendants, which is in the Supreme Court of this state. Now, I say it's a game. The game is the defense of doctors, and the game is the patient's risk. And that's a bad game under the present standard. Unless there is any reason to continue the argument, I will go to what I think is really more important as an argument before this court, and that has to do with the particular application on informed consent. Your Honor, the
applicant... Before you get into that, and maybe you're going to approach it, but I'm particularly interested in What evidence is there in the record that Dr. Allen, who's the general practitioner, was negligent in this particular instance? Oh, then he got Dr. Matthews in, who actually, as I understand it, testified that he did the actual delivery. He's the one that used the forceps. He's the one that did the injury to the child. Where's Dr. Allen?
Your Honor, initially, the young plaintiff testified that Dr. Allen used the forceps, but he only used one section of them, that he went into the vaginal area in an attempt to move this child with a single forceps, or piece of the forceps, and that in doing this, he was using it in a manner in order to apply against the pelvic bone to try to extract the child because it's in a brief position, either bring down an arm or leg. It's conceded by both doctors that this would be improper. Their contention is basically that even if he did that, he could not have possibly reached the child's head as long as the child was in a breech position. Now, breech being simply buttocks down coming through the vaginal area.
So that he could not have injured the child,
even
the child's head.
Even if he did that, according to them. But the problem with that is there's no assurance. You're talking about defendant's own testimony. No question the child's in a breach, but this child turned at one point of time, admittedly, in an effort to try to be extracted. They tried to turn it to a head-down position to remove the child. And in the version attempt, he would have put the child horizontally across this girl's body. And if he went up with the forceps at that point, and tried to use it like a crowbar, he would fracture the child's skull. So,
but the position of the fracture would indicate that he didn't do it, wouldn't it?
The position of the fracture, as I understand it, is more properly and more likely caused by the application of the forces by Dr. Mack.
But there's no absolute proof, then, of who did the injuries, what you're saying.
That's correct, except the jury findings and the judicial admissions of Dr. Matthew that he caused the fractures.
Okay, well then.
And then there is other testimony in the record from the neurosurgeon as well as from the radiologist. That testimony was that this is a type of fracture which will occur from use of a forceps.
Okay, well, if Dr. Matthews admits that he did it, why is Dr. Allen liable?
Dr. Allen's liability stems from the informed consent aspect of the case.
Okay, and that's what you're fixing to get into.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And, Your Honor, the application is granted on the basic premise that we do not have necessary evidence to show a standard of care for informed consent. The application is rather novel in one of its statements, and that has to do with this statement. The informed consent theory is by its very nature expressly limited to procedures yet to be performed. That's rather novel. I don't find any place in Texas law that says that's true. They go on and basically say that the child acquires no legal rights until he's born. Therefore, since apparently he had the fractures when he was born, their contention is that no informed consent could ever apply to the failure to inform the parents of the probability of fractures of the skull. Now, that's crazy. There's no reason for it. Number one, the law of the state makes the parents the natural guardians of the child. In fact, under the new Medical Practices Act, it specifies various parties who can be a person giving consent in the absence of a parent. Obviously, a 3 or 4 hour old child or even a 4 month old child would not be able to get any type of consent. Once this child was born, this doctor owed an affirmative duty, a fiduciary relationship, one of trust and confidence applied to this child. And it was his duty to inform the parents of the relative risk and complications of a skull fracture. In the entire testimony in this record, each of the doctors say, yes, there were bilateral indentions. There was a swelling of the head. There was evidence injury there from the forceps. Their contention was, though, basically, we knew that these type of injuries could occur, but we didn't know that this child's skull was fractured. Now, that's their pure argument. We just didn't know it. But both defendants admit that the only way you could find it is to go ahead and run an x-ray on child at a relatively small expense, and it could have been done before
the child. Assuming a duty to get informed consent to do what?
Informed consent is to get whatever diagnosis and treatment is necessary.
Informed consent to do what?
You're talking about...
Usually implied consent is implied consent to do something or not do something. As I understand it. And you may think that's crazy, but that's the way I understand it. Now, what consent do they need from the parents to do what?
Well, Judge, informed consent means the right of a person to have sufficient information to make an intelligent and knowledgeable election to do or not to do something. And that's the definition in short form. Now, what did the parents have the right to do? If they had been properly informed of the damage to the child, they would have done exactly what they did 3 or 4 months later. They took him to a neurosurgeon and had the fractures corrected.
So you're not talking about implied consent to breech deliver the baby, implied consent to use the forceps or not, implied consent. Everything had already been done, as I understand it, to which they would need consent as far as the doctor's actions are concerned, the defendant doctor.
Right. It's a matter of discharging the child from the hospital with no knowledge of the fractures, no indication that something needed to be done to diagnose it, no indication of the probable permanent injuries the child could sustain from having the fractures if it were not diagnosed and treated.
But isn't that kind of a misnomer or misuse of the term informed consent or implied consent to... what you're talking about is just information that the parents should have gotten from the doctor so that they could have made a decision about what to do about the child's head.
That's what informed consent is.
Well, who needs the consent? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
The parents, in this instance, needs to receive the information.
So that they could consent.
So they could either consent to the non-treatment or not. My time is up. I'll be glad to answer any other questions, but I didn't want to transgress on the court's time that's allotted to me. I have 10 minutes, and I would like to close and argue solely that issue, and I'll bring it again to the court's attention. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Is there your argument from counsel for Dr. Allen?
Dr. Allen will be represented by Mr. Rod Patterson.
May it please the court, my name is Rod Patterson. I'm here today on behalf of Dr. Dale Allen, and he is a petitioner in the case. His petition for, rather his application for writ of error has been brought on the question that we just left off just a minute ago, and that is the informed consent question in this case. Specifically, he complained of the submission of the case to the jury in the first place. There was an issue, I believe it was issue number 8, that inquired as to whether Dr. Allen failed to obtain the informed consent of the parents. The question has been raised already. Informed consent to do what? The situation here is that Dr. Allen was a general practitioner in the Grand Prairie community. He was assisted by Dr. Matthews, who was the co-defendant in the case. Dr. Matthews was an OB-GYN specialist. There were other doctors involved in the delivery as well. At one point, there were a total of 4 doctors in the delivery room, each in attendance upon this patient. Now, the Court of Appeals held that the plaintiffs did not have to prove departure from the community standard of care in order to take an informed consent case to the jury. To me, that is a red herring sentence in the opinion that stands out like a sore thumb. Specifically, they have said you don't have to prove deviation from the standard of care because if you can prove standard of care, and that's a very big if also, but if you can prove standard of care, then it's up to the jury to decide whether or not the standard was departed from. That violates the very principles that this court has enunciated for informed consent cases, beginning back with Wilson versus Scott, which is a decision that I believe was about 15 years ago. And that case has pretty well dictated everything that's been you might say it was the granddaddy of all informed consent cases for the state of Texas. Basically, what Wilson told us was, to prove informed consent, you have four things to prove. Those four things are a standard of care, and specifically, I think the opinion said you have to prove a standard of what a medical practitioner should disclose to his patient about the risks that are involved in the procedure. The second thing you have to prove, also by expert testimony, is departure from the standard. And that's where the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth, I submit respectfully, has gone wrong, because they held you didn't have to prove that. You didn't have to prove it by any means, not by factual testimony or by expert testimony or by anything. They've omitted an entire finding for an informed consent case. The third thing the court said in Wilson versus Scott you have to prove is causation, also by expert testimony, at least in part by expert testimony. And then there's damages. Four elements. One of them, the Court of Appeals has said, you can leave out entirely. That, it seems to me, is where the Court of Appeals has gone wrong. Now, the court reasoned. They said, well, here what we have is two doctors that have taken the stand and testified about how they do things. Dr. Allen specifically testified about his contract with his patient. And there was some in-depth quoting of the testimony of Dr. Allen and his contract with his patient. Now, the business about contract with the patient is all very well and good, but that has nothing to do with establishing a standard of care. The only reason that a contract between physician and patient is relevant at all is because it establishes whether or not there is a physician-patient relationship. Once that relationship exists by contract, which is either implied or expressed, then the doctor owes a duty which arises not out of the contract at all, but rather out of the law, that fiduciary relationship that's imposed once the relationship exists, and that duty is to exercise ordinary care under the same or similar circumstances as what other doctors in the community would exercise. And all of that testimony that the Court of Appeals quotes in its opinion is relevant only to the fact that a physician-patient relationship existed with respect to the mother, also to the child once it was born. That has never been questioned. It was never a fact issue in the case. The closest that they ever got to establishing a standard of care through Dr. Allen's testimony was probably in one question that I believe was propounded by Mr. Holloway when Dr. Allen was on the stand, and this is at page 6 of the typewritten opinion, if you'd like to refer to this later, Your Honors. The question read, would you agree, sir, that in 1976, under the circumstances, that medical procedures between doctor and patient would be to advise the parents of the possibility that such a fracture exists in order that the child could be evaluated by a doctor later and proper x-rays made? Now, I find problems with the way that question is stated. It calls for the correct procedure. It does not ask what the standard of care is. It doesn't ask whether other procedures would be correct. But that is the absolute closest. If they established, got close to establishing a standard of care for doctors in the community in 1976, that is the absolute closest they got. The question was answered by Dr. Allen. Yes, if the fracture was assumed to be there. It was a conditional thing. The doctor was saying, yes, advise the parents of the possibility of a fracture if it is assumed to be there. All right? Now, how do we plug that in to see if the standard of care, if that is one, and I just for the sake of argument, let's say, suppose that is the standard of care that's been developed in this case. How do we plug that into this case? Well, we need to look at the record. This is a no-evidence case from my client's point of view, and granted, that requires the court to look at the record and find all of those things that would support the submission of the issue to the jury and the findings in regard to it and disregard anything else to the contrary. But the facts of the case are totally devoid of anything that indicates any of the doctors either did or should suspect that there was a fracture. There is no evidence from any expert, and I think there were a total of three or four experts in this case, there was no evidence anywhere that anyone should have suspected fractures. At one point, when Dr. Matthews was testifying, this very question came up. And again, recall that Dr. Matthews is a highly trained OBGYN who has a higher, presumably a higher standard of care, and of course the general practitioner such as Dr. Allen would not be held to those particular standards. But in any case, Dr. Matthews was asked, Is it true that at least at one time in the operating suite there were actually four doctors present? Answer, right. Right after delivery, yes. There was Dr. Allen, Dr. Hudson, the intern, myself, and Dr. Roy. Question, okay. And none of the four of the physicians that were in attendance at that time, to your knowledge, reasonably expected this child to have had a fracture? The answer from the specialist, no. The facts that are in evidence do not support the so-called standard of care that the plaintiffs have tried to develop. And consequently, there's no evidence that there was ever any departure from the standard of care, particularly on the part of Dr. Allen. Actually, on the part of any doctor involved in the case, there's no evidence of any departure anywhere. What the court has tried to do, the Court of Appeals in Fort Worth, has said, well, what we'll do is...
Counsel, was the child's head x-rayed after the delivery?
Your Honor, my recollection is that it was x-rayed a while after the delivery. There was some time that passed, and it became evident that there might have been a problem somewhere down the road, and the child's head was x-rayed. But immediately after delivery, no, it was not. Again, I think that was a problem with the pleadings, because there was no contention that there was failure to x-ray or that there was negligence in failing to x-ray. That really did not enter into the case at the trial level, Your Honor. All that was pleaded, and I don't have my transcript with me, but what I recall is what was pleaded was two specific acts of negligence, which, by the way, Attorney Holloway has not read to you, and I will read to you if you will. It was alleged specifically that the defendants were negligent, one, in failing to obtain the parent's informed consent, and two, in failing to refer the infant for surgery when the defendants knew or should have known that the infant suffered fractures of the skull. Now, the second allegation was never fully developed. I think it was brought out in the plaintiff's testimony, but there was never any expert testimony anywhere, no issue submitted. Really, that's not before either the court below us or this court at this time. The only issue that the plaintiffs really tried to pursue.
If I see a child that's got holes in its head, that would disturb me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe it wouldn't take an expert to figure out that a child's got a problem that's got holes in its head.
Well, Your Honor, as I recall, the problem, of course, is not with literal holes or bleeding or anything. I think the problem is we're talking about indentions along the forehead where the forceps were used. And I think it was brought out in the testimony of probably Dr. Matthews that in the course of deliveries of numbers of these babies, that indentions, while they're not the kind of thing that occur every time a baby is born, nonetheless, they do occur on a regular basis, and it's not a sign for immediate alarm that we immediately have to get out the x-ray machine and see if this kiddo has fractures of the skull and that sort of thing. Apparently, this is not part of the standard of care for doctors who deliver babies in the Grand Prairie community or any other community that we know of. What they have said is, if there is reason to suspect that there's a fracture, at that point, you x-ray and determine whether there's a problem. And that, if there was a standard developed, that really is the only one. Now, on the basis of the testimony I'd gone over earlier.
Was there testimony that a lot of times that when children are delivered with forceps, that the head will have indentions, but it's not always indicative of a fracture?
Your Honor, I recall that there was such testimony, and I believe it was from Dr. Matthews, and I can find that for you after the argument today if you like, but I believe that was in the statement of fact. Now, that was the point, I think, that just the mere fact that you had indentions in the child's head is not immediately indicative that there is a problem that calls for x-rays or immediate referral or anything of that nature. What the Court of Appeals said was, well, we have a witness on the stand who has testified to something that they deemed a standard of care. And whether or not it was remains to be seen. But assuming that it was, they say, well, the jury can decide that the witness is not credible, and they can decide that despite his testimony to the effect that he followed the standard of care, the jury can, in its infinite wisdom, and with a lack of any real skill or training or guidance, decide that there was not conformity with the standard of care, that the doctor did depart, when there's no evidence to that effect. And that, I think, Your Honors, is exactly what Wilson versus Scott was trying to get around. The opinion recited from a prior out-of-state opinion, I think, that was very well reasoned, and it pointed out the dangers in allowing this kind of case to go to the jury without the guidance that must come from experts. If we did that, then we would have skilled persons in the professions. And it could be, in addition to the medical, it could be any profession, presumably by extension somewhere. But if we do that, what we've got is someone who is skilled being judged by someone who has not the slightest idea of what the standard of care is in that particular area, or what acts or what conduct was in conformity with the standard of care. Basically, it allows the jury to go ahead and apply its own unilateral decision as to what conduct is conformity with the standard of care. It allows the jury to speculate, to guess, and to do all those things that are so dangerous and can probably do to result in unjust verdicts. But the facts in this case show only that the medical experts, and all of them involved, had no reason to show that there was any reason to suspect there was a fracture at the time of the delivery or shortly after. And therefore, no reason to do anything further, and no reason to inform the parents about the possibility of fractures at that point. Now, really, that's all we're limited to under the plaintiff's very specific pleadings at this point. And the other thing I might point out in that regard before I go on is that we have several cases in the state of Texas that hold when you have expert testimony and it's uncontroverted, and if it's on a crucial issue that the jury has to decide, then there's really nothing for them to decide. They can't disbelieve uncontroverted expert testimony. A case that comes to mind is a medical malpractice case.
Oh, you're wrong about that, aren't you, counsel?
Well, in the context, if you have conflicting expert testimony, Your Honor, I think...
I had thought the rule was that the jury could disbelieve expert testimony no matter what. Right.
Well, the case...
I have opinions that effect.
Okay. I may have to back off that one. But the cases I'm thinking of, and I'll point these out to you...
I probably remember them too. That's the way I remember.
There's a case filed Ethicon versus Parton, and it's a medical malpractice case. In that case, there was a question about the right procedure to use for the insertion of, I'm going to say it's a hypodermic needle, but it's some kind of a needle, all right? And the question was how to do that. The standard of care was developed through, I believe, the defendant doctor in that case. Then the doctor stated that he followed that standard. The court held that there was nothing for the jury to decide. Now, if you gave the Fort Worth Court of Appeals opinion, literal effect in a case like that, we would say, okay, all we have to do to submit one of these kinds of cases, any kind of professional liability case to the jury, is we have to develop a standard of care and we can let the jury decide whether or not it's been followed. Now the question about that is, does the jury have the wherewithal and the capability to do that? Who can decide what conduct is in conformity with the standard of care but one who knows, one who has the skill and the training? Otherwise, we're back to speculation and guesswork again.
Well, now, if you have a standard of care, and I'm assuming that,
right,
and then there's testimony as to what happened, you're not saying, I'm sure, that you've got to have a expert come back up there and then evaluate what happened as to whether it did or did not meet the standard. In other words, you have a declaration as to the standard, and then you have testimony as to what happened. Now, from that situation, can a jury determine whether the standard was matched? Is what you're saying that you have to have a doctor get on the stand and say, I conformed to the standard, or he did not conform to the standard?
Well, Your Honor, I would think to the extent that only we were involved with fact questions, the jury is perfectly competent to evaluate that. However, in these professional liability cases, so many times the question is, how did you, we're getting a little bit away from the context of informed consent, I think, in this hypothetical.
Well, the term informed consent, we go beyond the Scott against Wilson informed consent, as Chief Justice was indicating. This is a step beyond that, and is calling on this court to impose a new kind or an additional duty after the procedure has been performed, which may be a good thing to do, may not be a good thing to do.
It would seem to me that the question in a case like that turns on what the standard is and whether there was departure from the standard, and does call for evidence from an expert to the extent that there has to be some determination from that field of expertise as to what should be done and some evaluation of what was done. If it's all black and white, if it's all pure fact and there's no question about what was done, and it could be explained or elaborated upon by a layman, then I think that that would be one kind of case.
Well, specifically, we have, let us assume that in this case it was very clear, undisputed medical testimony, that an x-ray should be taken if there are forceps marks. The proof in this case showed no x-ray was taken. Now, isn't that all that's necessary for a jury to determine?
Your Honor, if that was the case we were dealing with here, I think that probably would be so in that type of case. What I was proposing earlier was a situation where you're describing a type of procedure. For example, how a doctor should hold a scalpel in a surgical operation. Can a layman, such as, well, we're getting, again, beyond the field of informed consent.
Let's just talk about this case, the forceps. Right.
Well, the forceps, of course, the question there is really one that goes beyond Dr. Allen, because the every time the intention to interject the question of forceps into this lawsuit was brought up, it was repeatedly objected to as going beyond the scope of the pleadings. It was likewise ruled by...
Well, let's talk about the x-ray thing. Right. Let's forget the forceps. If there was evidence that an x-ray would be standard procedure, surely you wouldn't have to have a doctor in this case get up and say, well, an x-ray was or was not necessary.
Your Honor, I don't think so. The only situation I could see is where the question of whether or not the x-ray was taken with good radiological technique or was taken at the appropriate time, those questions that call for medical judgment. The facts, I agree with you entirely, have no problem about laymen deciding what the facts are. That's what they're for. They're there to weigh the facts. But when it goes into questions of medical judgment, about which the jurors don't know anything, can't expect to actually know anything, and if they did, they couldn't share that knowledge in the jury room to do it properly, to decide the case properly. In that kind of a case, then you do need the medical expert testimony. And I think that's what the cases have been holding consistently in the state of Texas, that is that you need expert testimony if it's not just a simple question of fact. If the question is, were x-rays taken or were x-rays not taken? Simple question of fact. But if it's something about a procedure or what should be disclosed or what should not be disclosed that calls for medical judgment.
It worries me a little that a layman can see indentations in the skull. They don't need the doctor to point out there's a hole in the head. They need expert testimony to say that this child has got indentations in his skull. And if they're not natural?
Well, Your Honor, I know that my time is up.
You can answer my question.
All right. The thing is, I think in this kind of case, what you've got is a situation where you have to rely on expertise to tell you whether or not those indentations are causing a problem. Because what one of the doctors has told us is that these indentations do occur without significant injury to the child. They do occur, and they resolve themselves within a couple of days. And this is to be expected. And this is normal in the field of obstetrics. And this is something, well, not normal, but this is something that can be seen from time to time.
Did the doctor tell the parents this, that you're talking about?
I'm sorry?
Did the doctor tell the parents that this is normal, don't worry about it?
I believe there was testimony to the effect that the indentions were, while not exactly normal, were something that could appear from time to time, and it was expected in the usual course of events that they...
You can go in and sue the originating carrier for all...